Okay, let's come back to the Mabinogion. So we looked yesterday afternoon at the first branch and this principle of sovereignty and lordship and will and power. Now we go next to the story of Branwen, daughter of Hlir. And this is a story that is all about death and destruction. Having been with the energies of life, of fertility, of the creative interplay with Anuvan, we're suddenly in another place. And we're with another group of people. We're with the House of Hlir. Now Hlir is the great sea god. He survives in Shakespeare as King Lear. And in Geoffrey of Monmouth, he gets locked up by his daughters. It's where Shakespeare got the idea from of the king who was betrayed by his daughter. He's an interesting figure, actually. We don't know a great deal about him, but he's one of the three exalted prisoners of Britain. And we find reference. We just find a little reference to this at the beginning of the second branch, because what we have in the second branch, we have Bendigi Vran, Bran the Blessed, son of Hlir, who was crowned king over this island and exalted with the crown of London, sitting at Harlech. And he is this giant figure. We get the image of a giant figure sitting on a rock. This is the High King. This is not the Prince of David. This is the King over all of Ynyspredain, over all of Britain, sitting on a rock, looking to the west. And beside him, there is his brother Manawatan, son of Hlir. And his two stepbrothers on his mother's side, Nissen and Evanissen. And these two brothers from his mother are the sons of a figure called Roswedd the Golden. And all we know about Roswedd the Golden comes from one of the triads, where he is the imprisoner of Hlir. So he locks up Hlir in order to have his way with Hlir's wife, Penavadin, who is the mother both of Bran and of Nissen and Evanissen. So it's a slightly uncomfortable beginning. So we have this figure. Great giant figure, the great king of the land, sitting out to sea with his brother and his two stepbrothers. But the father of his stepbrothers is the man who locked up his father to steal his mother. It's like a classic Greg Kevin Park family, come to think of it. At least the Greg Kevin Park I grew up in. It's got that kind of, oh my God, kind of feeling about it, right? It's a sort of, you know, and so there's an immediate sense of discomfort, and we're with this theme of imprisonment and loss and stealing, and, you know, so suddenly it's a sort of, this is a slightly complicated scene that the author has laid out for us. Further, we have a duality with Nissen and Evanissen, because Nissen is said to be the kindest, most lovely man in the world, whereas Evanissen, who is one of the great figures of the second branch, is this wrathful, dangerous, difficult figure. And we begin by looking into the west, looking towards Ireland. Now, the west for the bards is the place of the dead. It's the place where the sun sets. So we're looking into death. So we're in this strange, complex family situation, looking towards the other world, looking in the direction of death, having been with the direction of life and fertility. And we're with this figure, Emnisin, who is the good youth, who makes peace. And they say of Evnisin, Evnisin would cause strife between the most loving of true brothers. So he has this energy of strife, of destruction. It's an interesting echo here, actually, into pre-Socratic Greece. Yeah, that's in the room. Okay.
I'm not quite the expert.
No, you're not. That's fine. But what's interesting is there is a little echo of a pre-Socratic Greek philosopher called Empedocles, who his vision of the universe is following his master Parmenides, who saw the universe as one great sphere in which everything is connected. Empedocles looks at two fundamental energies of life. One that is connected to the goddess Aphrodite, that is love and enchantment, and the other that is the energy of destruction, whom he calls mad strife. And one of the great kind of, being a sort of philosopher very much connected to goodness and life, one might expect that Empedocles would follow Aphrodite. But what he says to us, I take mad strife as my teacher. And because he chooses the energy that destroys, the death energy, as his faithful companion, rather than the energy that can enchant us. And there's a similar kind of polarity here in Nisin and Evnisin. There is the good boy and the bad boy. So again, with lots of polarities. The other polarity we're with is Bran himself, who is the raven, and his sister Branwen, who is the white raven. Who's the other side of Bran in a way. Now again, the raven is it's a powerful bird, but carrion crow, carrion eater, the bird who feeds on death. The bird that therefore creates life out of death. That eats the dead, that and transforms the dead flesh into its own life energy. So in a way, it's a dark story, the second branch, but it's speaking for that the goodness of death and killing, the crucial importance of that. It's not easy for us to see sometimes, but particularly in the world you see lots of death and killing that isn't good at all. But one of our very early spiritual teachers was a very good gardener, and one of the things that he used to say about this is the thing that most taught him about this was just pruning a garden. You know, to prune a garden you have to be quite cutting, and quite ruthless. Because if you don't prune a garden, the life, the tangle of life that emerges out of that kills anyway, because the energy of death is deeply interwoven with the energy of life. You know, Nissen and Avnissen are twins. Now, what happens in the story is that Matholwch, king of Ireland, so out of the sea, out of the west, really, they see these ships coming. Now, again, if we go back into dark ages Britain, that to see ships on the horizon is can be quite an alarming thing. You know, because we're back in the time when actually the real commerce around, the real communication around Europe is on the sea roads. Now, what comes along the sea roads might be people wanting to trade with you, might be wanting people to give you things. Could also be people wanting to burn your house down, kill you and destroy everything you have. So it's a liminal moment when you see ships on the horizon. And the thing about the horizon, if you ever look out to sea long enough and you see a ship, because we see it so often, we see ships coming up. They come up out of nowhere. They come out of the edge of the world. So in a certain sense, they come out of Anuvin. They come out of the very deep. You know, we don't think of that either, because we know the world as a sphere and all of that. But actually, if we stay with the actual perception of that, the perception is of something coming up and then towards. So you can imagine that, in a way, the kind of anxiety, what's coming to meet us, and should we get ready, and sort of. But actually what happens is that Matholwch, king of Ireland, is coming with his. And Ireland isn't really Ireland as we would think of it. Now, Ireland is an otherworldly land. Right, so it's another version. In this occasion, in the first branch, the king of this world or the prince of this world goes into the other world. Here, the other world, the world of the West, the world of the ancestors, the dead and the spirits are coming to this world. Much as around it this morning. So the energy of the other world coming into this world. Yesterday we went into the other world, meet the hound there. Here, the around and the hounds came here. So this is a similar movement. And it's pointing at the same thing. The whole point about, when I talk about these stories is that what is being described in the story is literally what we're experiencing here. A different language, but it's pointing at the same reality. So here what happens is the otherworldly king comes to Bran, comes to his court at Harlech, and wants to make an arrangement whereby there will be relationship between the other world, between the otherworldly island and this island. Now, what happens is that there's agreement, and they're very happy, and they create a great marriage feast. Branwen agrees to marry Matholwch, and there's a great marriage feast is prepared. But what happens, either by oversight or by decision, is that Evnissin, who is stepbrother to Branwen, is not told anything of this. And this is pointing at a very powerful thing somewhere of the destructive energies being kept out. Because this is a feast of life, of marriage, of new beginnings. We don't want the destructive energies there. We don't want the wrathful Evnissin, who for sure will cause trouble. I haven't thought about this story because, most weddings of fights in the sort of the reception somewhere. You get a big family together, it's a wonderful time, wonderful. Come sort of 11 o'clock in the evening when the beers flowed all night, things come here, things end in tears. quite regularly. So there's a very odd kind of, you know, sort of, oh no, we're not letting this happen. You know, you'll create trouble, you'll create a fight, we'll keep him away. And what happens? He's totally outraged. His pride is insulted. He cannot bear this, and he then does a terrible thing. Now, the thing about these stories, they are, you know, beautiful medieval stories, but they're also very gritty and a bit dreadful, really. So one of the, because what happens, what he does in his rage, is he mutilates the colt, Matholwch's colt, the horses he's brought with him. Cuts off their lips. It's very graphic. It's an act of horrible mutilation. You know, it's sort of shocking. How could you possibly do that? You know, how could anyone do that? So that kind of outrage you feel when animals are very cruelly treated. You know, and it's very, you know, it's very graphically done. He sat upon the horses and cut off their lips to the teeth, cut off the ears to their heads and their tails to their back, and wherever he could clutch their eyelids, he cut them to the very bone. And he maimed the horses thus till no use could be made of the horses.
Horrible thing to do.
It's also an attack upon sovereignty, because horses, as we've seen in the first branch, are deeply connected with the sovereignty of the king. To be I don't know what this has come to be. I don't know if you've ever watched the Monty Python and the Holy Grail. All the kings, they don't actually have horses. They all pretend they're riding horses. And you can know, you know that great phrase, you can know a king because he hasn't got any shit on him because he's riding on a horse. And it's a really funny, I love that film, but it's a funny reflection of this ancient idea that was actually quite an horses are very expensive, rich people rode horses, powerful people rode horses. And in the Celtic tradition, this image of the king is confirmed by the horse goddess. So to attack the Matholwch's horses is also a terrible thing. It's a terrible economic thing as well, but it's also a direct insult to his sovereignty. And he consults with his advisors, and he decides, right, he's breaking off the marriage compact. You know, he's deeply insulted. He's going away, and Bran is deeply embarrassed because, again, great Celtic virtue of hospitality. This is a terrible thing to, you know, have insulted your guest and have done harm to your guest is awful, and maligns his own honour in a terrible way. So he makes great kind of restitution to him. He offers him new horses, he offers him gold and jewels and then we come to a very important but strange little bit. Then he offers him this cauldron that is in his keeping, which is the cauldron of rebirth. And I'll just read you this a little bit. It's quite, because it's actually very, very kind of critical. I will enhance the reparation still further, says Bendigeidfran. I will give you a cauldron, and the virtue of the cauldron is this. If a man of yours is slain today, cast him into the cauldron, and by tomorrow he will be as well as he was at the best, save that he will not have the power of speech. And on the second night they sat together. Lord, said Matholwch, whence came to you the cauldron that you have given me? It came to me, he said, from a man who had been in your land, a man who comes out of the other world. I don't know where he came from, and I don't know where he found it. And who is this man, said Matholwch? Chlasa Chlais, Gwynuid, rather, he said. And he came here from Ireland, and his wife with him, and they escaped from the Iron House in Ireland, where it was made white hot around them. It is a marvel to me that you know nothing of this. Lord, said Matholwch, I do know, and as much as I know, I will tell you. I was hunting in Ireland one day on top of a mound overlooking a lake, and it was called the Lake of the Cauldron. And I saw a big man with yellow-red hair coming from the lake with a cauldron on his back. Moreover, he was a monstrous man, big and the evil look of a brigand upon him, and a woman following after him. And if he was big, twice as big as he was the woman. And they came to me and they greeted me. Why, said I, how fares it with you? This is how it fares with us, Lord, said he. This woman, at the end of a month and a fortnight, will conceive. And the son who will be born of that wombful at the end of the month and the fortnight will be a fighting man full armed. It'll be a difficult birth, won't it? I took them for me to maintain them, and they were with me for a year. And for that year I had them with me without grudging, but thereafter then I begrudged them. Because for the end of the fourth month they made themselves hated and unwelcome in the land, committing outrage and molesting and harassing gentlemen and ladies. From then on my people rose against me to bid me part with them, and they gave me the choice, my dominions or them. I referred to the council so as to what should be done with them. Then we decided to make a chamber all of iron. And when the chamber was ready, every smith that was in Ireland was summoned, and every possessor of tongs and hammer. And they caused charcoal to be piled as high as the top of the chamber. And they had the woman and her husband and her offspring served with ample meat and drink. And when it was known that they were drunk, they began to set fire to the charcoal against the chamber, and to blow the bellows which had been placed around the house, with a man to each pair of bellows. And they began to blow the bellows till the house was white hot around them. Then they held a council there in the middle of the chamber floor, this is the wife and the husband. And Clasa waited until the iron wall was white, and by reason of the exceeding great heat, he charged the wall with his shoulder, and broke it out before him and his wife after him. And none escaped save him and his wife. And then, I suppose, Lord, said Matholwch to Bendigeidfran, he came over to you. Yes, said Bendigeidfran, but then he came here and gave me the cauldron. In what manner, Lord, did you receive them? I quartered them everywhere in my domain, and they are numerous and prosper everywhere, and fortify whatever place they happen to be with men and arms, the best that anyone has ever seen. Now this little strange story is a pivotal bit of this story, because Matholwch is revealing himself to be no true king, and Bendigeidfran is a true king, and because this powerful figure there's just layers within layers in the story, but he's describing this powerful figure who comes out of the lake of the cauldron, and so these are supernatural beings, bigger than human. So we're what the bards do when they're describing very deep energies of the other world, they're these massive kind of energies. Now, the central thing that a Celtic king must do is to preserve the land, but to keep faith with the promises that he makes. And so he receives these beings into his land, cannot control or contain them, and then breaks faith with them and tries to murder them treacherously. And we're being shown in this kind of very, very early bit of the story, we're being shown that Matholwch is not a man of his word. And that because the contrast that we're given is these same people come to Bendigeidfran, he accepts them into his kingdom. They become this actual protective, creative thing that really adds to his kingdom. Instead of which, Matholwch uses them as a hate figure and uses them as a way of, in some ways, carrying favour with his own people. It's an odd reflection of the current immigrant situation that we have really in current days, where actually people have been welcomed in and then become hate figures. rather than their difference, their strangeness, their apparent monstrousness being accepted and received. And there's this powerful motif which gets repeated later in the story of a house, or a house which contains being created, which actually is a house of treachery. And this idea that this place which is going to be full of fire and just burn them, and what you then get is this powerful bursting out energy from literal bursting out energy. That's the place of that. From Chlasa, and that cannot be contained, that breaks out and goes to another place. Now, there's a certain way that Chlasa has a connection with the idea of blue enamel. And blue enamel, one of the things you find in the Prithaya Noon, we're told that the rim of the cauldron is ridged with enamel and pearls. Because enameling was this incredibly, again, medieval, that comes mostly out of Southern Europe and Arab countries. And it's this incredibly beautiful, magical thing. You know, if you look at enamel thing, it glows. And it's in the sense, it reminds the medieval Celts of that, of the other world as the many-colored land, the land that, which is much brighter, much more beautiful than the world that we know. And so this monstrous Chlasa comes out of the lake of the cauldron, who is a possessor of the cauldron, and who has this enormous wife who is perpetually fecund and creating new life. These are the energies that somehow cannot be contained, or rather Macholuch cannot contain them, but Bran can. Now, Bran, of course, is another giant figure. He, in a way, part of what's being said, that he is up to the job of being able to work with these deep energies. Macholuch cannot. And what happens is, and so there's this strange thing where the true king, the great king, gives this gift to the, back to Macholuch, a gift that's already been rejected because it already was at his service. So this is something very strange. You know, Bran is giving this back to him, and sort of in the, you know, and it's almost what will he do with it now? You know, what's going to happen? And what happens is, of course, that Branwen goes off to Ireland, and all goes well at first. And she gives birth. She gives birth to a boy, Gwern, who is going to be the new king of Ireland. And for a little while, all goes well. Except that what happens is that people start talking to Macholuch about how insulted he was, and how insulting Bran has been to him, and how insulting the Welsh have been to him, and what is he doing with this Welsh woman sitting beside him on the throne, and because she is part of this shameful kind of family. And Macholuch once again shows that he cannot align himself with true kind of sovereignty, because rather than protecting Branwen, protecting his wife, the mother of his child, he goes along with his advisors, and she is banished to the kitchen, where she has to be. This is a classic, you know, almost international folk tale thing, where it's a Cinderella. She's chucked into the kitchen. She has to do all the horrible jobs, and once a day, the cook beats her, strikes her a blow upon the head. And this is called, in another triad, this is called one of the three unhappy blows of Ynyspredain. Because this is the blow that causes war between the other world and this world. Because Branwen, in a sense, is the... is that energy of this world, the person from this world who goes into the other world and is not honored. The whole point about this relationship between us and Anuvin, there has to be equal respect for each. So what we have here is the image of that other world place where the the human world is not respected. And what happens in the story is that Branwen teaches the starling to talk and sends the starling across the water to talk to Bran and tell him everything that has happened. Starlings are the most amazing birds. Just near where we live in Wiltshire, there are thousands of starlings. We don't live in Wiltshire, no, we live in Somerset. We used to live in Wiltshire, thank you. It's good to remember. Be handy later on, we come to drive home, know what county we're in. But there are these extraordinary starlings that fly in the most extraordinary, I've seen them on TV sometimes. They make what's it called?
Murmurations.
So they make these amazing shapes in the air. And if you ever look at an individual starling, if you look at them from a distance, they don't look anything much. They look, you know, brownish birds. They have the most iridescent plumage. They're full of green, blue specks and golden specks. They're genuinely magical, otherworldly birds. And there's this great, you know, tradition in Welsh tradition about animals moving between the worlds as messengers, much like the hounds of Annan. And so this time we have this bird flying across the water, the starling flying to Bran, who is the great raven, to tell him about the injustice and the lack of and the dishonor that is happening to his sister, the white raven. And so what happens then is he rouses the armies of Britain for war, and he is such as this vast giant figure that he brings together this great assembly, and he wades out to sea. He goes by wading because he's so big that he can't be contained in a boat. And they do a whole thing, they gather, whenever they get these great musterings in the Mabinogion, and there is named figures, all of which would have had their own story. Now, we don't have most of the stories, but they're interesting things to reflect on sometimes, you know. So we get somebody like Ulch Bonelip. The hell is Ulch Bonelip? One of the kind of qualities that these stories have, because they are oral stories, is if you get to wondering if the name Ulch Bonelip sticks in you somewhere, what you will discover is it will start to talk to you. You know, you sit brooding on who's Ulch Bonelip, and listen, not in your mind so much, but more in your heart. You will find that some figure, like Arawn appeared today, some figure will appear out of the other world and will start to tell you the story, or a story, of Ulch Bonelip. And that's because, in a way, that this what these stories point us into, I suppose, a place that Jung would have called the collective unconscious, but the more usefully the Bards would have just called it Anuvin, points us into the very deep thing where these stories are all pointing us into something that talks back. So get interested in, if you're reading the Mabinogion, in the mustering stories where there are these strange kind of figures. Now what happens is that he's off to war in Ireland, and Matholwch is, the swineherds of Matholwch are upon the seashore one day, busied with their swine. And because of the sight they saw upon the sea, they came to Matholwch. "Lord," they say, "greetings, God prosper you," said he, "and have you news?" "Lord, we have wondrous news. We have seen a forest upon the deep, in a place where we never saw a single tree." "That's a strange thing," said he. "Could you see anything else?" "We could, Lord. There is a big mountain close to the forest, and that moving, and a lofty ridge on the mountain, a lake on each side of the ridge, and the forest and the mountain, and all those things moving." "Why," said he, "there is no one here that will know anything about this except Branwen. Please ask her." Messengers went to Branwen. "Lady," said they, "what do you think this is?" "Though I am not a lady," she said, "I know what that is. This is the men of the Island of the Mighty on their way over, having heard of my woes and my humiliation. The forest that is seen upon the sea is the mast of ships and their yards. And what is the mountain? Bendigeidvran, my brother, who comes by wading. There was never a ship in which he might be contained. What is the lofty ridge and the lake on each side? He is looking towards his island, he is angered. The two lakes on each side of the ridge are his two eyes, on either side of his nose. So we've got this image of this vast being and this great forest passing the sea, coming to kind of punish Matholwch. And in a way, this is this real sense of the of now we're touching these very deep kind of energies. We're touching something kind of massive that's underneath everything. This powerful energy of the sovereign who is coming to put right an injustice, and who brings with him all the energy of the land, who brings all the forest and wades through the sea, and even brings the mountains to war. And it's a sort of, in a way, an apocalyptic story, the second branch. It's about the real clash between this world and the other world, and really working with the energies of destruction, and therefore also with the energies of rebirth. This cauldron, this strange cauldron, is kind of, which we'll come back to in a moment, is central to the story. But classically, what happens to Matholwch is he gets all his men together, but he immediately retreats. And he retreats to across the Shannon River, called in Welsh Llosglynon, and gets them to break the bridge down. And he puts magnets or lodestones at the bottom of the river that will sink any ship that goes across. So this is another key moment in this story, where the bridge. So we come to an impassable barrier. There is no bridge, and there is the equivalent of a sort of whirlpool that will suck everything down. And there's a great phrase that used to be the motto of Pont a Dewe Grammar that's used, which is Bid Ben, Bid Bont. So this is the thing that Brown says in relationship to this impassable barrier. Bid Ben, Bid Bont. He who would be the head or chieftain shall be a bridge. And what he does there is to lay his body down up across the river, this great giant, lays his body down so that his troops can pass. Now it's a very pivotal phrase, this, because actually we're talking here about the bridging of a chasm, the bridging between opposites. And it's got direct relevance to our inner work in a way, because the interplay here is, if you would be the one who is head or connected with the energy of origination, you must act as a bridge. You must let the opposites come together. And in a certain way, you have to lay your body down between the opposites. And it's a very direct thing in some ways, in that our body can hold opposites. Our mind cannot hold opposites. The mind can hold one thought at a time. So there's strange interplay with head and body in this story. If you'd be a true head, which is it's not non-cognitive really, you have to lay your body down and allow the battle of the opposites to happen through and across your body. One of the opposites that we might encounter, you know, out of a workshop like this is a feeling of, this is significant. No, it's not. This material is Something I want to study? No, I don't. It's just fantasy, it's reality. Now, something of that dialogue, I think, certainly in me, goes on all the time. You know, so I, you know, there's a part of me as I sit here telling you about all this stuff I've studied all these years and keep telling everybody is really important. There's another part of me that thinks it's a lot of nonsense. It's not a big part of me these days, but it is. It is part of the dialogue of doubt, of opposites. As I believe something, I disbelieve it. And I can't work that out in my mind. Well, I can. I can argue myself one direction, I can argue myself another direction, depending on what I'm doing, really. And different things will win at different times. But actually, there's no resolution to be found in my mind. If I very immediately, really, for me, if I just pay attention to that conflict in myself, it takes me back to this village. It takes me back to my relationship with being Welsh. It takes me right into the fact of this loving the Mabinogion, loving this landscape, growing up in a really dysfunctional family and a very narrow, difficult village that I hated and needed to get away from. And in a sense, part of my own journey into Anavin always involves traveling through that kind of territory. Now, my mind can't hold it, but my body can. So if I want to be Pen Anavin, or for a moment at least, I have to lay my body down. I have to be with those opposites and listen to them both. Listen to them both. And if I do that, then something has to die. Even a little bit. I mean, it's dramatic, little by little. But something has to die if I do that, because actually this is the centrality, importance of Evnissin, who is the death energy somewhere. Because something in that old conflict has to die for me to come back here, when, you know, it is a very powerful personal thing. You know, I'm glad to be here, and it's very difficult to be here. It's both, yes? And but in the coming, in the doing, so just being here, whatever I say or do, for me just sitting in this room and being here means I confront very directly these opposites in myself. Welshness, not Welshness. Love being here, hate being here. Intense Welsh family that I love and hate. I have to be with my dad. Most of them are dead now. I'll come on to that in a moment. But that's this bid ben bid bont is a central kind of practice, but it's about the body and embodiment. You have to feel both edges of it. You know, I can feel the part of me, the Hiraeth part that yearns. I feel the rejection, the kind of, it's like the body that does that and then does that. You know, so by working with that, working with the conflict, working with the difficulty, what happens is something dies, right? Because the conflict has to die. The place is, it's not the energies of life that can help the conflict, the repetitive conflict. The more life I put into that conflict, the more both sides become energized. You know, I love more and I hate more. Now that's fine at one level. You know, there's something great about feeling intensely. It doesn't resolve the conflict, though. Because what resolves the conflict is the death of the conflict. Something, you know, that awful New Age phrase, let go. Everybody says let go. Glastonbury, everybody says let go. You want to punch them. Because actually, you know, it's not, oh yeah, well, could I would. Fuck off. You know, don't speak pious words to me. Because actually, to let in the death energy is the difficult thing. And this whole story is about how hard it is to let in the death energy. And what we see happening all the time is because, you know, in a sense, that kind of wrathful energy that you find in Ivnissen. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's this great concept called wrathful compassion, which is this energy of love in clear action. That is a destructive energy that breaks down delusion, that breaks down the things that keep us trapped. And in a way, the absence of Evnissin at the marriage means that what is not seen is a matholoch is not a good king. You don't give the cauldron, you don't give your precious sister to a king who's not a good king, who isn't going to honor her, who's actually going to abuse her. And what then happens is the story continues. The author continues to show us, Matholoch can't come and have a fight. He can't fight it out at this point. What he does is he creates a house, and it's an echo of what's happened to Chlasa. So he creates a house for Bran that's big enough, a great impressive house that's big enough for Bran to sit in, because Bran never gets to sit in a house because he is so big. And he prepares a great feast, and he says he'll make reparation, it's a parallel to Bran making reparation to Matholoch. So the story always echoes, there's a lot of parallelism all the time in the story. So you've got Bran who does this great feast and gives this precious thing the cauldron, and his precious sister. And then so we have Matholoch now promising to do something similar. But what happens is that actually Matholoch is planning to kill Bran and everyone from Wales by treachery, because there are bags hanging around the room, sacks of wheat, and we're back with the bag image that we find in the first branch. What's in the bag? It's the magician's hat. It's the mysterious place. And what's in the bag on this occasion is an armed warrior waiting for when everybody's got a bit drunk and they're planning to come out and kill them. So there's this house of treachery. Now the person who saves the day here and protects the people of Britain is Evnissin. It's kind of gruesome, really, but it's worth reading because it's here. So Evnissin comes into the house, ahead of the rest of the host, and scans the house with fierce, ruthless looks. So you've got this energy of that kind of wrathful kind of energy, that kind of fierce, intense. It's that kind of clarity of that kind of destructive, clarifying energy that looks into corners, that sees what's there. And he perceived the hide bags along the post. "What is in this bag?" said he to one of the Irish. "Flour, friend." And he felt about him till he came to the head of the warrior, and he squeezed his head until he felt his fingers sink into the brain through the bone. And he left that one and put his hand upon another. "What is here?" "Flour," said the Irishman. He played the same trick on every one of them until of all the 200 men he'd left alive, there was only one. And he came to him and he said, "What is here, friend?" They're also making a joke about Irish being stupid, because he's asking the people in the bags, "What's here?" And they're saying, "I'm just flour." So it's like he got his old, of course, Irish Welsh jokes in this instance. So he felt about it, and it's the last one, "Flour, friend." And he felt about him until he came to his head, and he squeezed that one's head as he had squeezed the head of the others. But this one he could feel armor on this one's head. He left him not until he had killed him, and then he sang an englyn. "There is in these bags flower of a sort, champions, warriors, attackers in battle, against fighters, ready for the fray." So this kind of wrathful energy cleans the house, destroys in a fairly graphic way the danger. And then the host comes into the house, and what Matholoch has promised to do is to give up his kingship and to give it to Gwerin, who of course is the son of Branwen, and therefore and thus Brendigeid Ranulf will feel satisfied. And So this looks like, okay, peace is going to be made, and we're going to finally have got rid of the destructive energies, where all is going to be well. And Gravan, the young boy, is about to be king, and everything is going to go really well. And Evnissen says, and always making a big fuss of the boy. And Evnissen says, okay, give the little boy to me. I'm his uncle, and you know he's a lovely boy. And let me celebrate him becoming king. And they give the boy to Evnissen. And he chucks the boy into the fire. Horrific act. And he provokes, therefore, tremendous war. Because he's killed the King of Ireland. The King of Ireland might be his own nephew and a small boy, but he's killed the King of Ireland. And now there is this enormous war that happens. Full-on battle, apocalyptic battle. So the energies of destruction are completely released. One of the problems that Bendevivran and his host have is that the Matholoch has the Cauldron of Rebirth. So every time they kill anybody, he gets chucked into the Cauldron of Rebirth and is reborn. Not able to speak, but reborn. And so everything starts to go very badly for the Welsh side. Until Evnissen places himself in the cauldron, pretends to be dead, hides himself among the Irish dead, pretends to be dead, enters the cauldron, and we have this powerful scene where he is pressing out against the cauldron with hands and legs, and eventually breaks the cauldron, shattering his own heart in the process. And destroys the cauldron, destroys himself. On the heels of this is just an apocalyptic battle which everybody dies, apart from 7 warriors of the Welsh and 7 women from Ireland, 7 pregnant women from Ireland. And it's this energy of shattering, of explosive stress shattering, which kills also the destructive energy. It's like the total leveling of the ground, right? So it is like the whole. It's almost like the whole of Ireland and Britain get wiped out. So we're left with 7 in Ireland, 7 pregnant women in a cave. We're left with 7 warriors, and Bran himself has become, who is the original Fisher King in a way, is pierced, and the idea that they say euphemistically he's pierced in the thighs, but what we really know, he's pierced in his groin. And he's been pierced by poison spear. And he asks his warriors to cut off his head, because his head will remain alive. And so what happens is that the 7 warriors and the miraculous head and Branwen is the 8th, return back to Wales. On coming to Wales, Branwen is so overcome with sorrow that she dies and is buried in Anglesey in a 4-sided grave. Now this whole story really is really about it's very similar to the story Prithianovin, which is about the raid into the other world to recover the cauldron, to bring the energies of life back to the land, and to heal an ancient injustice. So in the poem, we have the prisoner Gwaiya, and in the story, we have the imprisoned Branwen. But we also have this journey into death. Right? So the journey into the energy of killing, like that, which is really about this working with this wrathful energy that clarifies the field. Because what we're with, one of the subtleties of the story, is actually it's not a true king, and it's not a true cauldron either. Because the cauldron that is there, the people come out alive again, but they cannot speak. They don't have the independent power of expression. They cannot sound the awen. So it's all about the appearance of life without the substance. And it's all about the essential nature then of being able to work with that death energy that destroys the places that poison the wells of life. And where it takes, it takes both places to the potent place. So it takes we have these seven pregnant women in the cave. Ancient, so it's like you have the seven mothers of the other world. You know, you have these figures that get a lot of Romano British myth, the mothers, the realm of the mothers. The deep place of Anuvin where new life is created. In Britain, you have the assembly of the noble head. You have the seven who return from Anuvin, who return from the raid. You have that which comes back. It's like that these places that come back in us that are now in communion with the miraculous head. Who it's the essence of Brahman, who is himself now the true head of the other world, the place of origin, the place of origination, the place from which life comes. And they're in you're in this otherworldly feast with this head, and the birds of Rhiannon are singing to you. So the energy of Rhiannon is wrapped around you as well. So you're in this liminal place now where new life is going to be created. Out of destruction, out of death, out of annihilation. They're in both places, there's something new is going to emerge. And you know, the importance and so the centrality of this line, Bid Ben Bid Bont, and the centrality of this figure of Evanescence, because the subtlety of this work, if you engage with the death energy, it also extinguishes itself. That energy, because actually what happens in the end is a central thing where the cauldron explodes, and so does Evanescence. So when its job is done, it's done. So there's a place of actually the field is clear. But these terrible things that he keeps doing in the story are so that there isn't a false peace made. Because actually these tendencies of prevarication, of collusion, that allow the seeds of a new disturbance to emerge have to be rooted out. And so you see that place where the energy keeps on returning, keeps on spiraling round. So it begins with horses being killed. The next thing is that the stirring up of war, so that actually there shouldn't be a false peace. In fact, the arrangement should not happen at all. And the thing is, the reality is, and the reality that the bards are pointing at is that, of course, we have all made these deals. You know, deals where we have, in a way, given away our own sovereignty, given away our own authenticity. It's necessary. These are things that we do. But if we're going to transform ourselves, and what the bards say, if you want to be Pan Anuvin, if you want to be an originative center of life, well, you know what, you have to let this energy go all the way down. Keep trusting that disturbing energy that is Evanescence. And there's something very, you know, there is the point where he enters the hall is an interesting one. This fierce, ruthless gaze. There's like this kind of concentrated mind that can really look into the corners. That sense of presence that enables us not to deceive ourselves. And that has to kill the treachery, the internal treacheries, the things that hide in the bag. And there's an interesting subtlety in it, really, that if you engage with these things that are disguised as flower, they speak back. He's making a joke about Irishmen. But they do speak back, so they will tell you, no, absolutely, you know, I'm not really flower, no, I'm here kind of to kill you, really. So, all right. You know, but the dialogue, that you know, it's very intense, these stories. Every detail has meaning. And even the detail. So what the hand going into the head, going the horrible detail of the hand going into the flower, it is like you know you're putting your attention down into the deeper place, and then you grab hold of something. You don't know what you've grabbed, and it's really like when you pay attention inside, you grab something. You can sort of feel the shape of it. You don't know what you've got, but you keep penetrating it. It's like your awareness, your concentration keeps focusing in, focusing in, focusing in. You go through the barrier of the bone into the brain, into the place where something, and then it is like that centripetal energy that squashes, kills, releases something, and something alters. And he has to do that 200 times. And on one of the occasions, somebody's even got the barrier is even stronger. There's armor on top, and he has to keep doing that. It's a very realistic description of working with our own inner collusions, our inner traitors, in a sense. And then, if you at the end, what happens? You know, the false cauldron is destroyed, so you're kind of left with nothing, which is sort of. Oh my God, we're left with nothing. What do we do? Why did I do all this? And that often can be the feeling that comes after you've, you know, worked with destroyed old patterns in yourself. There's a kind of emptiness. But what the story, the images the story gives us at the end are these images of, yes, sure, feels empty now, but there's all this potential new life. There is the realm of the mothers, of the pregnant mothers in the other world, the island. There is the feast of the noble head. And you have to rest here, because what happens is in the story is that they rest in this listening to the stories of the noble head. So in a sense they have to listen into the kind of the deep place, listen to the birds of Rhiannon, listen to the song that the head is singing, the oracular head is singing. And they do that until the head says to them, you can do this, but don't open the door that leads to Gwales. Otherwise, which is also the door to the outside, really, in a way. So, because if you do that, then the feast will come to an end. And when the feast comes to an end, you must all return to your own place. And when you return to your own place, I would like you to bury my head underneath the White Tower of London so that I can protect the land, so that I remain deep in the land as a teacher and a guide of these mysteries of death. So I am, and of course we've got this interesting, you know, theoretically he was buried underneath the Tower of London, except Arthur comes and digs him up later on, which is said to be one of the three unhappy disclosures of the island of Britain, because Arthur can't let Brown rest there, and that's a whole other story. But of course what's interesting is even today that the Tower of London is guarded by ravens. So these ancient things echo down the hundreds of years. So that is the story of Branwen, daughter of Clear. Need to have a break for a cup of tea, I think. Anybody burning with a question before we do that, just to see? No, good. Let's pick up the...